Today we're going to create a mashup, a fun and adventurous way to make something fresh out of something stale.
I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me. I'm the best ever. There's never been anybody ruthless. There's no one that can match me. My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable. And I'm just ferocious. I want your heart. I want to eat his children. Praise be to Allah.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Injection, fellas.
My mother's mother's personal library had over 1,000 books, and her bedroom closet was cluttered with guns. And she helped raise her first grandson with a switch and a message. Her patience was not to be tested. A nurse who taught 2 languages and expected her progeny to excel. Quick to tell you, tough titty, raised 4 children by moving back and forth between southern and northern cities, told my mother, no way. Yeah, you and that baby can move in, but ain't no grown man moving into my house on no day. No pity. The bosom was warm, but the gangster was gritty. Pretty girl, piano player, singer, matriarch, cared for her parents for years while secretly dying of cancer, but still never let anything tear her family apart. My grandmother, Eula English, was my heart. My mother's mother's mother was a school teacher. A black woman with a college degree in the 1930s and 40s, long before these underachievers came up with excuses, would do whatever she had to do to make sure her descendants didn't end up shiftless and useless, use candy to motivate the children in the neighborhood to study the Bible because she believed that that was where the truth is. Ruthless when disrespected, connected nouns and verbs to put your self-concept in check, could be expected to rip your ego apart, named after a city in Texas. My great-grandmother, Galveston McNeil, was my heart. My mother's 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 mother was a rider, type to show up inside her son-in-law's living room and just take over, tell him, look, I'm like a general and I raised my daughter to only roll with soldiers. Born in 1882, transcended 3 years before my start, famous for lighting cigarettes and putting men in their places, my great-great-grandmother Sarah Gist was my heart. My father's mother was a social worker, a black woman with a college degree in the 1950s who bought a house for her siblings and her parents and raised her children to either get educated or get busy. Told her husband, look, if I'm going on a vacation, you could best believe my grandson is always coming with me. Comprehended. Told my mother, if anybody steps to my grandchild and gets knocked out, never punish him if he gets suspended. Just ask him how it'd start. My paternal grandmother, Flora Acey, was my heart. And my mother is a black nationalist with a master's degree in mathematics who's been programming computers since before they had keyboards. I'm talking punch cards. And didn't care about my rough housing in the street, but if I ever disrespected her, I got punched hard. And then hit with switches till I blacked out like them computer glitches. And if I came home with B's, she would make me study more to ensure I get the picture. Like tons of megapixels, she developed me to be sharp. Still my favorite person in the world, my mother, Jacqueline Acey, is my heart. I'm a father to my son, and I've been one since the beginning. But every advantage I've ever given him has been the product of 5 women.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
Recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist. But there are other communists who don't show their real faces, who work more silently.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- This is NBC Nightly News, Thursday, April 12th. Reported by John Chancellor with David Brinkley's Journal.
Good evening. The United Nations Security Council today took on the Lebanese complaint about Israeli commando raids, and we'll have a look at that. We'll also see what happened in Beirut today when they buried some of the Arab guerrilla leaders. The United States today began taking diplomatic action against Palestine guerrilla radio broadcasts, which had been blanketing the Middle East with a Hate America propaganda campaign. Secretary of State Rogers today called in 13 Arab diplomats to tell them that the United States had nothing to do with Monday's Israeli commando raid on Lebanon, as the broadcasts have charged. Rogers asked their help in stopping the broadcasts, which have originated in 7 Middle Eastern countries. The State Department today called the charges a big lie campaign.
I think he misremembers.
Smoky-eyed at night, stars up in the sky. I see the sailing boat across the bay go by. Eucalyptus trees hanging by the street. And then I turn my head for you. Wash our feet near the immortal shrine, and then our shadows meet, and then we drink the wine. I see the hungry clouds up above your face, and then the tears roll down. What a bitter.
The idea of transforming what is really impermanent, make it permanent, is also something which is, you know, magic, and it comes out of fairy tales.
And it really is the stuff of fairy tales, a golden cape made entirely of spider silk.
It involves about 80 people going out every morning collecting spiders, which are brought back to what we call the spidery, where we can extract directly from the spider's spinneret the silk.
The brainchild of Piers and his friend Nicholas Godley, the Gossamer garment was made with the help of a staggering 1.2 million golden orb spiders and took 4 years to produce. Each insect was clamped inside a device and its thread wound out, with the designers anxious to stress that all spiders were returned to the wild unharmed, a compliment that wasn't always returned, as their scars testify.
Thank you. across the bridge in the dismal light. There all the cars are screeched between the gates of night. I see the trembling.
Mom, at just 10 years old, the tale of a young girl from Colombia. She's a member of the Wayuu tribe, an indigenous group from the northern Venezuela-Colombian border, who arrived at the hospital in tears. Doctors say she was confused by the sudden pain and didn't realize what was going on.
Yes, she is a young girl from the Wayuu tribe. She is 10 years of age and this is her first pregnancy. In this particular case, it was critical to perform a cesarean section due to the circumstances of the patient and pregnancy. The baby is growing healthy and at birth weighed approximately 2,500
grams. The circumstances surrounding the girl's pregnancy are unknown, and despite her being underage, Colombian laws allow indigenous tribes like the one she's from a certain degree of self-governance. The case will be investigated by police, according to the tribe's laws.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Mum and dad in Argentina have told of the astonishing moment they discovered their newborn baby alive in a morgue 12 hours after she had been declared dead. It's thought the little girl, who was born 3 months premature, was taken away before her mother, Analia Buta, was even given the chance to hold her. At the time of birth, I don't remember much because I was put to sleep. They never showed me the baby. Analia and her husband, Fabian Veron, went to the morgue to say goodbye, and it was only when they forced their way into the casket, they say, they made the discovery.
My wife was the first one to look at the body, and she uncovered it slowly. That's when it let the first little cry out. My wife jumped back, like saying, "This must be my imagination." I went back to look again and she was moving, so I started to uncover the face and it was like she was just getting up, waking up. And that's when the lady from the morgue grabbed her and brought her.
Health officials have confirmed they are investigating the incident.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
I wish one of your guys had children so I could kick them in the head or stomp on their testicles so you could feel my pain, because that's the pain I have waking up every day.
Everyone knows the story of the Titanic. How the largest moving object ever fashioned by the hand of man hit an iceberg on its maiden voyage and sank in the middle of the North Atlantic. 1,500 lives were lost. The tragedy has been well documented in books and on film. No matter how often the story is told, it never fails to capture our imagination. Yet, it is a story that has left many questions unanswered. Now, for the first time, we take a fresh look at some of the mysteries surrounding the Titanic and reveal evidence that leads to a compelling and shocking hypothesis that the ship that plummeted 2 miles to the bottom of the sea was not the Titanic, but its sister ship, the Olympic.
It was a marvel of the modern age, a ship its operators billed as unsinkable. On April 10, 1912, the RMS Titanic, crammed with over 2,200 passengers and crew, departed from Southampton, bound for New York. For many on board, the voyage was an opportunity to escape poverty and create a new life. For other, wealthier passengers, it was an enjoyable social voyage. The ship docked at Cherbourg and Queenstown in Ireland before the crossing to New York. But just 5 days in, early on the morning of April 15th, the ship hit an iceberg, tearing a vast hole in her side. Chaos ensued as Titanic began taking on water, and the crew and passengers scrambled for what few lifeboats there were. Many left half full, leaving those trapped on board to their fate. Just 3 hours later, the ship split in half and sank, with 1,517 lives lost. Just 1 hour later, rescue arrived for the survivors in the shape of the Carpathia, a passenger liner. The ship would become a legend, spawning books and one of the most successful films in Hollywood history. More importantly, it would also result in a shipping safety revolution, which has endured to this day. But the greatest legacy of the disaster is the memory of Titanic herself, a name which conjures images of one of the most memorable tragedies in maritime history.
Tonight, at the graves of 1,503 victims on the Titanic.
A memorial service is held on board a cruise ship in the North Atlantic to mark the 100th anniversary of the Titanic disaster, before the names of those who died on board the ill-fated ship were read out.
Mr. Mark Fortune. Mr. Charles Alexander Fortune.
The Azamara Journey, which has sailed from Canada, is one of two ships to converge on the spot where the boat sank a century ago. The Balmoral left Southampton last week, with 50 of its passengers having a direct family connection to the sinking.
It's almost as though while I was here, he was alive for me, and I can let it go.
Shortly after the Azamara's service, held at midnight on Saturday, passengers gathered on deck to see wreaths thrown overboard.
Children lost their lives. It was sad when that great.
Titanic and the Olympic were built for the White Star Line by Belfast shipbuilders Harland and Wolff, whose chairman was Lord Pirrie. Harland and Wolff built ships almost exclusively for the White Star Line, which was acquired in 1903 by American financier J. Pierpont Morgan's International Mercantile Marine. This was part of a drive to create a monopoly on the lucrative North Atlantic passenger trade. Chairman of the White Star Line was J. Bruce Ismay. It was in fact Lord Pirrie who was responsible for bringing together Morgan's money and British engineering excellence. Over dinner at Pirrie's London residence in 1907, Lord Pirrie and White Star Line's Bruce Ismay conceived the idea of building three luxurious superliners. First the Olympic, then the Titanic, and finally the Britannic. The first of the new ships, Olympic and Titanic, were to be virtually identical.
When they were building the Titanic, they said what they could do. They were going to build a ship that the water could not go through. But God with his mighty hand showed to the world it could not stand. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. There were husbands and wives, little killed and lost their lives. It was sad when that great ship went down.
On the 14th of June, 1911, the Olympic made her maiden voyage under the command of Captain Edward J. Smith, Commodore of the White Star Line. Then just a week later, still under the command of Edward Smith, the Olympic was involved in a stern collision with the tug O.L. Hallenbeck in New York, an accident that nearly caused the tug to sink. Barely 3 months later, on the 20th of September 1911, the Olympic, still under the command of Captain Smith, was involved in yet another collision, this time with the British warship HMS Hawke in the Brambles Channel in Southampton Water. It was a serious collision which was to seal the fate of the Olympic. Pulled in by the suction from the Olympic's great propellers, the Hawke is irresistibly drawn towards the larger vessel and the two ships collide. The Hawke's underwater ram and bows strike and penetrate the starboard side of the Olympic, causing a triangular hole several meters high and an even larger hole below the waterline.
When they left England, they were making for the shore. The rich, they declared they would not ride with the poor. So they sent to go below, they were the first they had to go. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. There were husbands and wives, little children lost their lives. It was sad when that great ship went down.
Besides being holed both above and below the waterline, she sustained numerous other injuries, including steel frames buckled, thousands of rivets popped, steel plating dislodged over four decks, and distortion to the starboard propeller and crankshaft. To make matters worse, the keel was bent, giving the ship a pronounced list to port. Interestingly enough, when 6 months later the ship which came to be known as the Titanic made her maiden voyage out of Southampton, second-class passenger Lawrence Beasley, a science teacher, noted that the ship seemed to have a slight but permanent list to port on the first part of the voyage, a fact noted by several other surviving passengers. The great hull was patched up in Southampton by riveting steel plates below the waterline and reinforcing with wooden beams above. This work took over 2 weeks, suggesting just how serious the damage was. In October 1911, with these temporary repair works in place, the Olympic then limped back to the Harland and Wolff shipyard in Belfast for more permanent repairs to be done. In fact, some of those temporary repairs failed during the voyage to Belfast.
When photos out being with me and all around, God in heaven on his own said that man should was sad when that great ship went down. There were orphans and wives, little children lost their lives. It was sad when that great ship went down.
By the way, remember that although this is a model of the Olympic, the two ships were virtually identical. It's this fact which made a conspiracy feasible, a conspiracy of monumental proportions.
People on the ship were a long way from home. We had friends all around them, didn't know their time had come. Oh, death came riding by, 1600 had to die. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was sad when that great ship went down. There were husbands and wives, little children lost their lives. It was sad when that great ship went down. It was said they were singing, "Hear my God to thee, hear my God to thee." And that great ship went down.
Although three quarters of a century at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean did not exactly preserve Titanic in museum-like condition, there is enough left of the wreck to give us more than just an idea of what really happened. Corrosion has done its relentless work, but where the original black paint of the hull has flaked away, it is still possible to see spots of grey paint, which formed the undercoat. Except that grey paint was only used as an undercoat on the Olympic and not on the Titanic. Examination of the starboard propeller reveals the number 01 stamped into the metal. In fairness, there is too much corrosion to make out the number 4 clearly, but remember, the starboard propeller, numbered 401 for the Titanic, was put on the Olympic as part of the repairs after the collision with the Hawk. Remote cameras under the control of the discoverer of the Titanic wreck, Dr. Robert Ballard, have examined the stern section of the ship. They show that in addition to the lateral bulkheads that were a feature of both the Titanic and the Olympic, there is a longitudinal bulkhead in the stern section where there was none on the original plans for either vessel. The position of this bulkhead suggests a temporary repair has been carried out to strengthen the keel, a keel perhaps damaged by the collision with HMS Hawk. And finally, a close look at the bow could reveal the most damning evidence of all. In 1986, the French National Oceanographic Institute examined the wreck with Dr. Robert Ballard. One of the things they checked was the name of the ship. In keeping with White Star tradition, both ships had their names engraved into the upper bow plates in letters 4 foot high. Examination of the wreck and the name Titanic shows that it is made of iron letters which have been riveted onto the original bow plates. With the passage of time, two of the letters have dropped off and been lost forever in the sediment of the seabed. At the place where they once were, engraved into the hull, are the letters M and P.
Conspiracy theories.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
Today we will learn different methods you can use to be a crook.
Method 1.
The unsophisticated, short-sighted crook confronts a person directly and threatens him, usually while brandishing a weapon, and demands whatever money or other valuables the person has on him. While this method is fairly popular and sometimes effective, it has some drawbacks. For example, confronting someone in person poses a significant risk to you, the crook. Even if you only pick on smaller, weaker individuals, you never know when they might be armed. Furthermore, using this direct method involves a high likelihood that sooner or later you will be recognized, tracked down, and punished, whether by the victim, a bystander, or the police. And after you've done the crime, you get what you get, whatever your victim happened to have on him, and that's it. A one-time deal, usually with an unknown prize, maybe even nothing.
Method 2.
A slightly better way to be a crook is to break into houses when no one is around and see what you can steal. While there is some chance that you'll be noticed and confronted, the risk is a lot lower. And the average house is likely to contain a lot more valuables than the average person carries around with him. Nonetheless, there are still risks involved, and a high chance that you'll leave behind evidence, footprints, fingerprints, etc., that could later get you into trouble.
Method 3.
The more sophisticated crook avoids the risk of violent confrontation entirely by using fraud and deception rather than direct threats and violence. For example, you might call up little old ladies and trick them into giving you their credit card numbers, or set up some mail order scam that collects money and then magically disappears. The personal risk to you, especially the risk of being physically attacked by your intended victim, decreases dramatically. However, you might still get caught, and each time is still a one-shot deal. You get what you get and run the risk of getting in trouble, one crime at a time.
Method 4.
The next step up is to create ongoing frauds, methods that don't just rob people once, but that create recurring theft. For example, if you trick little old ladies into giving you their credit card numbers, instead of just having a quick shopping spree, you could set up a bunch of smaller, repeating thefts. A little old lady who gets charged $9.95 a month, which shows up on her credit card statement as helping poor orphans, is unlikely to question it. Get 100 little old ladies to do it, and you have an ongoing cash stream, without having to commit a new crime and incur new risks every time. Of course, there is still some risk of getting caught and punished.
Method 5.
A far better method of theft than any discussed so far is counterfeiting. While this requires serious technical and logistical resources, it has huge advantages. First of all, there is no direct victim who will even notice having been robbed. By printing fake money, you are actually robbing everyone who uses the currency. However, not only will they not notice the difference, but most people don't even comprehend why counterfeiting is bad or how it hurts anyone. The risk of your actual victims retaliating against you is therefore almost zero. The risk of them even knowing they were robbed is also almost zero, and wouldn't be much higher even if they knew you were printing your own cash, simply because most people have no idea what money is or how currency works. Once you're set up, you can create an ongoing source of wealth for yourself with very little physical risk. Of course, if the authorities find out, then you're in trouble. But aside from that risk, this would seem to be the pinnacle of the art of being a crook, having an unlimited supply of completely unearned wealth for yourself while the victims never know what hit them, and in fact, never know that anything hit them.
Method 6.
The next step is only for truly sociopathic crooks, who don't just want unearned wealth, but want to dominate their fellow man. It's again based on counterfeiting, but instead of just printing money and buying stuff with it, you print money and loan it to other people. At first, this may seem counterintuitive. If you can just print as much money as you want, why bother to loan it or give it away? Well, suppose you print up millions of dollars and then lend that to hundreds of different people. They will each then feel indebted to you as if you did them a favor. From then on, they will rob themselves every month, giving you a pile of money while feeling a moral obligation to do so. Ironically, because they imagine the debt to be real, as if you actually loaned them your own money, they would view themselves as the crooks if they ever stopped going along with your crime. In fact, you should sometimes intentionally lend your counterfeit money out to the point where you know that people can't possibly pay it back. Why? Because when they default on the phony loans of your phony money, you can openly steal their houses, cars, and other property by way of foreclosure, and they will feel bad about it, as if they were the bad guys for not being able to keep up with the payments. While you openly steal everything they have, they will apologize for not giving you more while feeling shame and humiliation. What could be better? And the more you steal via this method, the more you can expand the fraud. There is really no limit. Eventually, if all goes well, you can have almost everyone in the world feeling indebted to you. And when they default, you will quite literally own the world. And most of your billions of victims will have no idea what happened. They will all be reduced to impoverished slaves for you to do with as you please, you sadistic, megalomaniacal, sociopathic bastard.
Method 7.
The previously mentioned method is so effective, in fact, that there's really only one way to improve it. The only risk involved, up to this point, is that the authorities might notice and catch you before you can slip off to some non-extradition treaty country with your ill-gotten gains. To remove that final risk, take the final step and bribe the politicians to legalize your crimes. When the authorities have given their official legislative blessing to your massive perpetual fraud and even offer to send their mercenaries to protect you against your victims, should any of them ever wise up to what you're doing, then you will be the supreme crook of the world. However, you cannot accomplish this. You will never be the super crook who owns the world. Why not? Because someone else beat you to it. In this country, they're called the Federal Reserve. They own Congress, which legalized their fraud in 1913. Since then, through their politically sanctioned fractional reserve banking scam, a fancy term for legalized counterfeiting, they have stolen more trillions of dollars in assets than you can possibly imagine. The crime is so perfect that they even do it right out in the open, admitting all of the details of the scheme. And still, only a tiny fraction of their victims have any idea what happened.
Let's begin. Take it down and up. Zip it up. Good. Take it down. Right here you should feel it. All right in that rear end. Good. Wonderful.
Something caught my eye the other day. Pat Robertson, the high priest of the religious right, had some startling things to say about drugs. I really believe we should treat marijuana the way we treat beverage alcohol, Mr. Robertson said recently. I've never used marijuana and I don't intend to, he said, but it's just one of those things that, well, I think this war on drugs just hasn't succeeded. The reason Robertson is for legalizing marijuana is that it has created a prison problem in America that is well beyond what most Americans imagine. He's right. Here are the numbers. The total number of Americans under correctional supervision, prison, parole, etc., is 7.1 million, more than the entire state of Massachusetts. No other country comes even close to our rates of incarceration. We have 760 prisoners per 100,000 people. Most European countries have 1/7 that number per capita, so it's adjusted for population. Even those on the high end of the global spectrum, Brazil, Poland, have only 1/4 the number we do. Now, if you say this is some kind of enduring aspect of America's Wild West culture, you would be wrong. In 1980, our rates of incarceration were 1/4 what they are now. What changed was the war on drugs and the mindless proliferation of laws that have created criminal penalties for anything and everything. If you don't believe me, listen to Pat Robertson again.
We here in America make up 5% of the world's population, but we make up 25% of jailed prisoners. We have now over 3,000, the number must be much higher than that, but over 3,000 federal crimes. And every time the liberals pass a bill, I don't care what it involves, they stick criminal sanctions on it. And so we have the jails filled with people who are white collar criminals.
In the past 2 decades, the money that states spend on prisons has risen at 6 times the rate of spending on higher education. In 2011, California spent $9.6 billion on prisons versus $5.7 billion on higher education. Since 1980, California has built one college campus. It has built 21 prisons. The state spends $8,667 per student per year. It spends about $50,000 per inmate per year. Why is this happening? Well, prisons are a big business now. They are privately run, they have powerful lobbyists, and they have bought most state politicians in America. Meanwhile, we are bankrupting our states and creating a vast underclass of prisoners who will never be equipped for productive lives.
Today's news, fresh news, is mostly of the unconfirmed category.
All right, we're continuing our round-the-clock coverage here on the front lines of Election 2012. Jason Copeland is with us. He's going to walk us through the delegate election process in Montana, the only state where party members slug it out in a bare-chested brawl to determine who gets their votes. Right, Jason?
Absolutely, Andrea. And like you said, it's a rather unique process, as you can see on the hollow ring here, if we could bring this up. Love that. On primary night, representatives for each candidate gather in the parking lot of this bar, the Stumble Inn on Highway 15 in Missoula.
Now, it looks like each group is staking out its spot.
That's exactly right. So you have Mitt Romney supporters gathering themselves over by the handicapped parking spaces.
I see.
The Santorum supporters over here by the dumpster. Undecided voters in the ditch with the rusted out car door.
Okay.
Now, what'll happen is after sizing each other up, the supporters will all take off their shirts. Women generally keep their bras on.
Right.
And go at it in a chaotic, no-holds-barred, bloody mass street fight.
Okay.
And the last man standing receives all of Montana's 26 delegates for his candidate.
And now listen, some people are going to say that maybe it's time for Montana to move to a more modern process.
Well, you know, Montana's a very unique state in that way. They value individuality. They value brute physical strength. It's the only thing they trust. It's tradition.
Sure. Now, what kinds of strategy goes into play? Because this is a whole new ballgame.
Yeah, just like any other state, it's all about the undecided voter, right? So it's about pulling the undecided voter over to your side. So representatives will do their best to beat undecided voters unconscious, drag them over to their corner like we're seeing here.
Interesting. How long does this go on for, Jason?
Well, if it extends beyond 2 hours or so, they are allowed to start using baseball bats and broken bottles and campaign signs.
Okay.
In our simulation here, we can see that Mitt Romney is winning by quite a margin.
Okay, so Jason, who are the odds with for taking Montana this year?
Well, totally a toss-up. You have Romney and Gingrich making appearances in the state trying to court the bigger, stronger voters. But then you also have Montana Governor One-Eyed Sue, who is endorsing Rick Santorum publicly.
Is she?
And she will be there, and that's a big boon for him.
Absolutely.
And she is quite the scrapper, by the way. I mean, she punctured a man's scrotum with her teeth in the 2000 election.
Okay. Well, we'll all be watching to see what happens. Thank you, Jason. All right, moving on. Newt Gingrich has just received an important endorsement from Fat Criminal magazine. We're back on the front lines of election 2012. Obama's poll numbers among his Democratic base are way down. The reason, analysts suggest, liberal voters just want to see Obama sweat a little before they inevitably vote for him. Jason, fill us in.
Yeah, Andrea, pretty interesting. Take a look at this. A full 63% of registered voters say they're undecided about who they're voting for. But when pressed with a second question, okay, but seriously, when it comes down to it, who are you really going to vote for? 89% say Obama.
Well, but still, that lack of commitment has to be keeping the president up at night.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point. Democrats are disappointed with the president's first-term performance. Basically, they want to make him suffer a little bit.
Okay, Jason, let's see what some of those so-called undecided Democrats are saying.
I don't know who I'm going to vote for. I've been seeing some real nice ads for Mitt Romney. We're flashy and sophisticated. Hear that, Obama?
Honestly, I've never voted anything but Democrat my entire life, but I don't know about this year. How does it make you feel, Obama?
It sounds like voters are really just getting back in for a very disappointing first term.
Yeah, you know, they've been pulling together all sorts of stunts just to screw this head. For instance, they're talking about this all-day jazz festival that they're going to attend on November 6th, pretending that they've forgotten about the election altogether.
Okay, and Jason, how long do you think Obama's base is planning to torment him
this? Well, it's looking like it might be a while. I mean, there are even rumors that at the Democratic National Convention, when they're about to announce Obama's name, they're actually going to call Dennis Kucinich's name.
Kidding.
Love this. He'll come out, pretend to accept the nomination. Obama's just going to pee himself. That's going to be so hilarious.
Wow. I mean, I have to say, all of this has got to be rattling the president, and indeed I think it is. He released a statement today saying, quote, listen, I know I haven't been the best president in the world, but I'm sorry and I really will do better. Just say you will vote for me. Say it. I'll do anything.
I mean, would you believe that four
years
ago?
Well, and, you know, look at this. The Obama 2012 team also unveiled this new campaign poster.
God, I love that. That is
He's
just
on his
so
knees.
Pathetic.
Ridiculous. Now, what about Biden? Doesn't he also have to be nominated at the DNC?
Yeah, they've tried the same tactic with Biden. Didn't quite work. DNC chairperson Debbie Wasserman Schultz approached him. She said they were, quote, exploring their possibilities for vice president, but Biden just winked at her and said, all right, baby, why don't you call me when you get your head together?
But surely if politicians used words like holla, swallow back, check this out, all my peeps in your cribs, all your mofos out there, swallow this, booyakasha wagwan, then people would hear it and understand, didn't it?
The whole world watching the mysterious nuclear nation of North Korea.
for the sign that they are indeed launching a long-range rocket, what America calls a secret attempt to test a ballistic missile. Shortly before we came on the air, word that the rocket is ready for liftoff, and ABC's Bob Woodruff is heading into North Korea for the fourth time. He is watching the story for us tonight. Bob.
Good evening, Diane. We are in Beijing, China right now. We're on our way into North Korea. U.S. officials actually tell ABC News they believe we are 24 to 48 hours away from the first possible window for North Korea to launch that 90-ton rocket.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then.
This is the North Korean rocket that has the Western world worried. The Unha 3 is, North Korea says, simply a space lift rocket which they have every right to launch. They've even shown it off to foreign journalists and say such an action wouldn't make sense if the system had any military use. The 90-ton rocket is due to blast off on April 14th, sending a weather satellite which will also play patriotic songs into space. However, many believe it's a covert test of a nuclear ballistic missile system. That would violate UN conventions, and the US has already stopped food aid to the state as a result. The North insists the launch is peaceful. Its neighbors are nervous.
I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space. On such a timeless flight. Gonna be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh no, no, no. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out his fuse out there alone. And I think it's gonna be a long.
Covering up the failure of a much-hyped attempt to send a weather satellite into space, North Korea replaces scientific glory with communist pageantry. A vast statue has been unveiled in Pyongyang in front of thousands of onlookers and officials, showing deceased leader Kim Jong-il standing next to an existing statue of founding father and eternal president Kim Il-sung to commemorate his 100th birthday. Not a huge amount is known about the vast bronze statue, but it is likely an attempt to boost the cult of the family and strengthen the position of new leader Kim Jong-un. If there's one thing communist states do well, it's ceremony, and this was no different, with tens of thousands of party officials offering gifts to the former leaders as they smiled on benevolently. It's unlikely they would have been smiling, however, at the failed attempt to send a satellite into orbit and cement the North's position as a spacefaring nation. It crashed into the sea minutes after launch.
Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there to raise them. If you did, all the science I don't understand. It's just my job 5 days a week. A rocket man. A rocket man. And
Over the world, and then I'll always be lonely.
Bonjour, Dika. Dosai ma. Hans Briggs, Dika.
Hans Briggs. Oh no. Oh, hello. Great to see you again, Hans.
Mr. Ill, I was supposed to be allowed to inspect your palace today, and your guards won't let me into certain areas.
Hans. We've been through this a dozen times. I don't have any weapons of mass destruction, okay, Hans?
Then let me look around so I can ease the UN's collective mind.
Hans, you're breaking my balls here, Hans. You're breaking my balls.
I'm sorry, but the UN must be firm with you. Let me see your whole palace, or else.
Or else what?
Or else we will be very, very angry with you, and we will write you a letter telling you how angry we are.
Okay, I'll show you, Hans. You ready? Stand ready to erect. Read them all.
Good.
There you go, Hans Briggs! How you like that, you cock? Yeah, you, Hans Briggs! Inspect that, you fucking... Time is running out. If I'm going to take over the world, I have to find a way to stop Team America.
But there was another, equally important aspect to the domestic propaganda campaign. If every adventure story needs a villain, it also needs a hero.
Waiting for someone that'll come and say, hey, this is it. I don't have to settle for defeat anymore. I can rise up out of my routine. I can get a hold of myself. I don't have to lose. I can win. There's something inside me that's not going to let me go down anymore. But I'm not the guy.
Now, an alien invasion, could it really happen? The U.S. military is making plans just in case. It is best to be prepared for anything, and Professor Paul Springer from the U.S. Air Command and Staff College would advise the military in the event of an invasion. He had to get special government clearance to talk to us, and I spoke to him earlier. Paul, it's an incredibly difficult thing, isn't it, to plan to fight back against an enemy we would know absolutely nothing about.
Well, that's absolutely true, but at the same time, we make all kinds of contingency and war plans against enemies that we never expected to face in combat. And so the idea that maybe the enemy will have something technological or doctrinal that we've never foreseen is something that we try to plan for any way that we can.
Well, obviously, if we did get invaded, these aliens would be much more technologically advanced than we are because we didn't even know they were there. How would you go about fighting an enemy that was just so infinitely superior in technology?
Well, the first thing you'd want to try to do is preserve your forces as best you could. You would want to learn as much about the enemy as possible, and that would mean things like trying to find vulnerabilities, trying to capture technology. But survival is your first priority, because if you send all of your forces into the field and have them destroyed by that superior enemy force, then when you do find a vulnerability, you won't have any opportunity to exploit it.
What do you think would be the alien plan? What would they do first?
Radio telescopes you're going to have to start at the beginning for us.
Right. Super cool. It'll be the largest and most sensitive radio telescope ever built, known to mankind.
Wow.
Quite literally, yep. So what that means is it'll give us a whole new capability to explore the universe, and of course from my defense perspective, check out what's out there, check out if there are aliens and if they have an appetite to, paying us a visit in an unfriendly fashion.
But don't worry, we're all going to be living on nothing soon enough. And, with a little bit of help from our friends, maybe, just maybe, I don't know. I have no idea.
We're involved in sort of a low-key war against apathy. I don't know how you're doing on apathy over there, but we got a lot of it, boys and girls. A lot of what we do is designed to annoy people to the point where they might, just for a second, question enough of their environment to do something about it. As long as they don't feel their environment and they don't worry about it, they're not going to do anything to change it. And something's got to be done before America scarfs up the world and sits on it.
Now, go find the others.com.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.